The Music Business Worldwide podcast is supported by Volley Music, a leading financial management platform for the music industry. Volley enables you to track expenses, approve invoices, and make payments 24/7, 365 days a year. For your free trial, head to volleymusic.com. That's VOLYmusic.com.
Hello and welcome to Music Business Worldwide's Talking Trends podcast, which is supported by Volley Entertainment, formerly known as Volley Music. My name is Tim Ingham, founder of MBW, and Talking Trends once again sees us look behind and beyond to recent entertainment industry headlines to give our quick take on them. I am delighted to be joined once again by Los Angeles-based Charlie Dattry, a music industry veteran, a sharp mind, and the founder of businesses including Dattry Songs, CC Music Royalties, and Best Quality M&M. That latter company manages the IP of legacy artists. During his career, Charlie has spent time at multiple labels, including nearly two decades at the company we now know as Disney Music Group. He's worked with artists including Public Enemy, Tony Bennett, and for a very long time, Queen. Charlie, welcome back to Talking Trends. Please pick a topic from recent music biz or outside music biz headlines that you would like to discuss this week and explain why it twigged your interest.
Well, hello, Tim. And I'd like to pick a subject this week that is in an analogous business. Many people from the music business certainly have patronized this place, but they're in the news this week, and that's Soho House. Now, Soho House, I think, is a fascinating story because they went into a sector, the private club, and had great luck in the media capitals and became sort of a desired place for people to be part of. They then expanded quite a bit, which led to some debt, which led to a public listing. And even at the time, and this is partially in the coverage of this week, even at the time, a lot of people had a quizzical expression because it's not typically the thing on a social club. What a social club relies on is desire to attend and stability. And public money can tend to be not stable. And then this week there is a raid by a short, which is trying to drive the stock down, which literally could cause the end of the chain. It's not necessarily the result. But regardless, it is something that is worth thinking about in the changes and the decisions we make about music companies, because there has been an entire movement for them to be both independent, some quite large, and to integrate public money as backers and capital partners wanted to cash out. So the point is that Soho House is just a poster child for what happens when you allow public money in and the potential implications. And what that means is that you have no idea if anyone wants to, if Tim and Charlie tomorrow have enough capital and we have a particular point of view, we can go in and start buying up stock, or alternatively, decide that we want to drive the stock down by saying bad things about them. And it has a real impact on the companies because finances are important.
Yeah, and there's obviously some very topical comparisons to be made in the music industry, one of which I'm actually going to use as my topic of this week. So I won't jump to that point. Obviously, with MBW, has been writing a lot. I'm sure you've been reading a lot about Hypnosis Songs Fund being one publicly traded entity that is effectively a basket of music rights. I was just taking a quick look at that this week, and I think it's got a market capitalization that's on the London Stock Exchange currently of about £750 million. I think that's right. So that's somewhere around a billion. I think it's just below $1 billion. And Hypnosis Songs Fund's been revalued. You probably saw that. There's a new valuer come in, and it's a bit more conservative than the value that was independent value that was previously used. And they've put Hypnosis Songs Fund's portfolio at a value of roughly $1.9 billion. So effectively on the public market, because of a lack of confidence, for one thing, from the public markets. Some might say a bit of panic when a certain number of metrics started to not look so attractive, so rosy for public investors at a particular time last year. Yeah, so they're trading on the public market around half the price they're being given by what most people would agree is a conservative, certainly versus what it was before, a conservative estimate from an independent valuer. I mean, again, this is a tale that public investors don't necessarily understand the full nuances of the growth story behind some of these businesses. They don't necessarily, in this case, understand the nuances or have confidence that those nuances would inform around music rights.
Well, entirely. And the question is, in a business that's inherently cyclical, is public money a good partner? I always like to quote here the great American investor Warren Buffett, who's made quite a lot of money on this very subject, which is that Wall Street, or the street in London, is manic depressive, which means that they're throwing money at you when you really don't need it. And then when you need money, they're trying to pull the money away. And so the question is, it's fascinating. We cited hypnosis, which I don't know that we intended to talk about this week. Hypnosis has both a public pool, which everyone judges on because that's the information that's public, and they have a private pool, which is not public, and we don't see the math on. So it's an interesting thing that when major investment partners came in on that fund, that they immediately said, well, we don't want this to be public. Not that they're trying to hide anything, but they're trying to keep out that manic depressive behavior. Because for hypnosis, if too much is sold, it leads to sales of catalog, which could cut into future profit, and it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. The public investors, who are important, it was always the greatest flaw and fear about hypnosis, I felt, from the beginning, which is that when you take in public money, you take in a certain level of sometimes hostile, sometimes just manic depressive behavior that doesn't necessarily reflect on your business. And in an inherently cyclical business, we have booms, sometimes we have level, sometimes there are busts as the public's tastes change, for example, or a particular media tops off and everyone's predicated their predictions on growth. And all of a sudden, well, it's still a good profitable business, but it's not growing the way it was. And I based my spending plan on continued growth. So the fact is that is built in. And when you take in that money, you have to have a plan. And it seems to me that what Merck did at Hypnosis was build in a lot of control aspects that make it very difficult to move him out of the person that's leading the place.
All of this talk about private versus public and whether or not music companies and companies that own or represent music rights benefit the most or are harmed by being on the public market also makes me think of Believe. And that is going to be our second topic this week. Interestingly, I did check this because I knew that we were going to talk about Believe before this call. Believe, shortly after it floated in France in 2021, this always seems to be the story, certainly at this arc of the chronology. Believe floated in 2021. A few months later, things are going great. It's bubbling up, the share price continuing to bubble up. It got up to about 20 euros per share. I think that was around the height. And just recently, before the announcement that triggered all of the things we're about to talk about, it was down to 12, so nearly half the public valuation of where it was. So again, speaking to the confidence or otherwise that public investors have in these music companies and quite how polarized that could be depending on which time of year we're talking about. So the second topic to target it directly in our discussion, Charlie, is going to be the sale of Believe, or at least the prospective sale of Believe, to initially, or so we thought, and it still looks the most likely, to a private consortium led by Denis Ladegallery, the CEO of the company, the founder of the company, and his co-investor in Believe, his existing co-investor in Believe, TCV, plus a Swedish private equity company called EQT, who have made moves in music before with Epidemic Sound and others. And then, as you've probably seen, that consortium has announced that it's effectively got signed agreements to acquire 72% of the Believe stock, not necessarily all public, but of Believe's share capital. And obviously, there's a minority remainder there. That offer came in from the consortium at 15 euros per share. I think it was announced last month in February. And we found out last week that there was a mystery party interested in potentially bidding for Believe at a higher share price. That party has effectively said to Believe's board, give us more details, let's see under the hood of the company, and then we may come forward with a 17 euro per share offer, which obviously enough is about 13% higher than the Ladegallery consortium. That party has now outed itself as Warner Music Group. And I'm just interested to talk around the idea of why Warner may be so keen to acquire Believe. I say that if I was a betting man, and I'm not, but if I was right now, I'd still say that the Ladegallery consortium looks to be in the driving seat and appears to be doing everything it can to expedite the deal so that it can get it over the line before Warner officially, if it ever does, officially announces a bid. So the first thing I'd like to say is back in January, I wrote a column about whether there was going to be M&A activity in the distribution market. We've just seen some what looked like slight fluffing of the press from SoundCloud or its investors around a potential $1 billion sale of that company, which yes, is a streaming service. Yes, is a user-generated content service, but it is also a music distributor. It distributes not just to itself, but to other platforms. And in that piece in January, the reason I'm citing it now is I pointed out two things. I pointed out that back in 2017, a story bubbled up into Nikkei. That's the second week in a row that I've mentioned Nikkei, that Sony Corporation, i.e. Sony Music Group, was on the verge of acquiring Believe. And the price was $445 million. So less than a third of even the Ladder Gallery Consortium price, or the value of the company under the Ladder Gallery Consortium price's acquisition. Just to give you an idea of that, the Ladder Gallery Consortium looks like it's valuing Believe at $1.6 billion-ish, and Warner looks like it's valuing Believe at $1.8 billion-ish. So $445 million, that was a figure in Nikkei saying that Sony was on the verge of doing the deal. The deal never got done. Believe has made some acquisitions since, but nothing like hugely material. Just a number of them. So it has grown the company via acquisition. But my sources tell me that when Sony was in those discussions, other major music company groups, including Warner Music Group, had similar discussions with Believe and didn't take that deal. So that was the first thing. The second thing that I pointed out in that January article is that Warner's, just on terms in terms of streaming recorded music right now, if you look over the last year or last year to last year and a half, Warner Music Group's streaming recorded music revenues sit at, they're not quite half Universal Music Group's, but they're not far off half Universal Music Group's. And that is a gulf between the number three in the market and the number one in the market. And it wouldn't shock me if Warner decides to try and close that gulf, at least partially close the gulf through acquisition. So those were the two things I pointed out in January. And what's on my mind now is, what's the story around Believe? What would be the primary thing that a major music company like Warner would be interested in? Well, for me, it's Believe's seeing the potential of the Asian markets early. I believe, no pun intended, small b, but I believe that in, I've looked at the financial year of 2022 for Believe. It runs calendar year. They haven't announced their 2023 yet. And Asia is at about a quarter of its overall revenues. By far, its biggest market is Europe. It did about $800 million in 2022. So around a quarter or just over a quarter, I believe, of Believe's revenues were in Asia. And then when I looked at Warner Music Group, it doesn't break out its international, what it calls international revenue, that's ex-US. It doesn't break it out so we know where in the world it is. But what we do know is just slightly under 50%, I think about 45% of Warner's global revenues are just in the US. For Believe, their revenues in the Americas, that includes Latin America and North America, I think they're between 10 and 15%. So if I'm Warner and I'm sitting there thinking, well, this unlocks market share in many important Asian markets. I'll focus on India for a second because Denis Ladder Gallery has on an earnings call claimed that Believe is actually the number two global player in India. Of course, there's various ways that you could cut and slice that, but I followed up in an interview with him and he effectively said, we believe we're the number two global player, so not just an Indian player, in the market on leading streaming services like Spotify and YouTube. That's hugely important to Warner. And then on the flip side, maybe Warner sees a strategic opportunity here to take the repertoire of Believe and push it into the US market, where, as I said before, Believe currently only has 10 to 15% of its revenues. It doesn't have a large operation versus its global competitors in terms of the other sort of four or five biggest companies in the market. And then the last thing, which I did point out in that article in January, but it's definitely worth mentioning, is that in January, Robert Kyncl, the CEO of Warner Music Group, he pointed out in a memo to staff that one of the things that he would be looking to do over the next 1 to 10 years, because he talked about it being the first of the next decade, was to accelerate Warner's presence in what he called the middle class artists sector. And what he really means there is artists who aren't directly signed to a major label group, probably have no real prospect or wish to be signed to a blockbuster label group, but are doing a really nice little bit of business for themselves, making a nice living with a dedicated smaller audience. And of course, that sector is growing and growing, and it's what Believe specializes in. So any reaction to any of the things that I've just pointed out that we could continue to talk more on?
Well, I think you're pretty spot on. And I do question from the perspective of the public investor, There's an argument that by going public, Believe opened the door for these people. And it's always tricky. They are operators, and I have great sympathy for that. They know their business better than anyone. But there is an ethical question when you're selling to yourself, and there are public investors who would expect to be treated equitably involved. And it may well be that all this results in the original group improving their offer in some way to the public investors. So that makes Warner go away. And I think you're dead on in terms of the motivations for Warner Music to want to pick up a piece like that. It is a hard, long slog to build up a lot of those assets, offices, staff expertise on your own. And since these are growth markets, as you so accurately pointed to, it's a shortcut to picking up effective market share and staff in these territories.
And just before we were on, actually, when we were testing levels and such like, you reminded me of the fact that Warner was actually widely seen as being one of the leading bidders for what was EMI on the recorded music side back in whenever that was, 2012, before Universal got the bigger piece and then divested a piece off to Warner in terms of Parlophone. So that set Warner back, if you like, versus in terms of that gulf between it and Universal. And then I've been thinking, you saw Universal acquire Ingrooves. They made that move not so long ago. MBW was existing, so I'm guessing that that must have been, I don't know, 2018, 2019, around then. And you saw Sony acquire The Orchard, finished that acquisition that I can date because it was the first year of MBW. So that would have been 2015 that it fully acquired The Orchard, which has done hugely profitable part of Sony's global operation. Not only that, it's hugely important to your, what you just referenced as growth markets. Look at The Orchard in Latin America and other parts of the world and its importance. And then, of course, we saw Sony buy Cobalt's AWOL, which at the time, amusingly enough now, I guess in retrospect, was an acronym for Artists Without a Label. And they still are. And they go through AWOL, which happens to be owned by a major music company. And that was explicitly targeting middle class artists. Willard Ardritz was the first person who was the founder of Cobalt. He was the first person I ever heard use the term middle class artists, although I think he asked me in print to call them middle tier artists because it might be a little less offensive. But effectively, that's become common industry parlance. And I believe Cobalt was once again slightly ahead on that. And so Warner hasn't made that Ingrooves AWOL style acquisition in recent years and potentially Believe could be it. But going back to your point on the race to acquire Believe, the fact that effectively Denis Ladegallery and TCV are acquiring equity from themselves as part of this consortium. What I read, I believe it was in Reuters, I think in France, they need to get to a 90% ownership of equity in order to squeeze out the other 10%. And I think that's French law. And so it really, I said, if I were a betting man, I wasn't, I'd still say that they are in front at the minute. And let's be honest, part of that is because Warner Music Group hasn't actually put an official bid in. So all of this could be a moot discussion, but they would need to get from 72 to 90. So those 18% of institutional investors, retail investors, public investors are going to need to be convinced that the 15 euro per share offer is just as sumptuous as Warner's potential 17 euro per share offers. Interesting times.
Yeah. And so, and it touches on so many different areas about the contemporary music business.
Love to keep going, Charlie, but we do promise the listeners that we'll keep this as short as possible. I have much more to say on that. I had much more to say on the public markets, but there we go. We will fulfill our promise to the listeners. And it just leaves it to me to say, Charlie Datchery, thanks for joining us. And we hope you tune in to Talking Trends next week.